Pacifica Radio presents This Was a Man. Today, the fourth program in a five-part dramatic documentary of the life of William Shakespeare, based on a research text by John Monteverdi and presented by Pacifica Players. Yesterday's program explored Shakespeare's life in London, his involvement with the theater, and the response to his work by his contemporaries. Today, we will deal with Shakespeare's private life, based upon his sonnets, his return to Stratford in the later years, and his success as a man of property.
Speculation concerning the private life of Shakespeare is infinitesimal when compared to the speculation occasioned by Shakespeare's incomparable sonnets. The sonnets were first published in 1609, and yet Francis Mears offers testimony that Shakespeare's sugared sonnets among his private friends were in existence in 1598. Sonnets 1 to 126 are addressed to or concerned with a young man whom the poet addresses in terms of affection and esteem. Sonnets 127 to 152 are addressed to or concerned with a young woman with black hair and a dark complexion. Sonnets 153 and 154 are free translations of a Greek poem and have no connection with the other sonnets. Sonnets 1 to 152 tell of four distinct persons: the poet, a handsome and well-bred young man, a poet who competes with the author of the sonnets for the affection of the young man, an amoral woman of unconventional beauty who at one time is the mistress of the sonneteer. Centuries of discussion have resulted in the general adoption of the terms the rival poet and the dark lady as convenient designations for the third and fourth persons. When Thomas Thorpe printed the sonnets in 1609, he wrote an infuriatingly enigmatic dedication.
To the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Mr. W. H., all happiness and that eternity promised by our ever-living poet wisheth the well-wishing adventurer in setting forth.
The first question concerning the dedication is the meaning of the only begetter. Is Thorpe, the printer, dedicating his book to the man who obtained the poems for him? Or is the dedication to the man who inspired the author of the sonnets, the man to whom many of the sonnets are addressed? If the dedication is to the man who obtained the sonnets for Thorpe, then the dedication sheds no light upon the identity of anyone spoken of in the sonnets.
If, however, the dedication is to the inspirer of the sonnets, then Mr. W.H. is the young man addressed by the poet in sonnets 1 to 126. Since most investigators are hopeful that the sonnets are a key to the private life of Shakespeare, most commentators choose to read begetter as inspirer rather than as procurer or obtainer. The next question then, of course, is who is Mr. W.H.? Every conceivable candidate has been nominated. Any man whose dates will fit and whose initials are W.H. or H.W., high born or low, is a potential Mr. W.H. Thorpe's use of Mr. would seem to suggest someone other than a nobleman, but a dedicated theorist can hurdle this difficulty.
The two men who have received the bulk of the votes are noblemen: Henry Wriothesley, Earl of Southampton, born in 1573, died in 1624, and William Lord Herbert, from 1601, Earl of Pembroke, born in 1580, died in 1630. The case for Southampton is based upon the known fact that Venus and Adonis and Lucrece were dedicated to him, and the reasonable conjecture that Southampton became Shakespeare's patron. The case for Herbert is based upon the known fact that Heming and Condell dedicated the first folio of 1623 to Herbert and his brother.
Supporters of Southampton must in some way circle around the fact that H.W. for Henry Wriothesley is simply not W.H. One way is to postulate that the reversal of initials along with the use of Mr. is for purposes of thin camouflage.
Supporters of the case for Herbert as the young man of the sonnets are less willing to believe that Mr. W.H. is someone other than their candidate, since the initials form a strong part of their case. And yet some of them are sufficiently influenced by the use of Mr. to grant that the dedication is to a procurer, perhaps printer William Hall.
Things begin to grow out of hand when that part of the dedication reading Mr. W.H. All is taken to mean Mr. W. Hall.
Another candidate for Mr. W.H. is our old friend Henry Willoughby of Willoughby, His Avisa. Again, the nominator must explain the reversal of initials.
Another candidate is a hypothetical boy actor named William Hughes. Oscar Wilde championed this theory, basing his speculation mainly upon Sonnet 20, which seems to contain a pun upon the name Hughes, or Hughes, H-E-W-S.
Once Thorpe's dedication is squeezed dry, there still remain the 154 sonnets and the identification of the persons alluded to in them. It is, of course, quite possible that all such attempts at identification are entirely off the mark, and that the sonnets are simply exercises in the Petrarchan convention.
It is just not possible, however, for searchers into the secrets of Shakespeare's life to give up the idea that the sonnets are autobiographical. The Earl of Southampton and William Lord Herbert had curiously parallel careers, which can be made to fit what is implied about the young man of Sonnets 1 to 126. Both Southampton and Herbert are known to have shown favor to Shakespeare. Both were good-looking and had beautiful mothers. Both were the subjects of early negotiations for marriages, which came to nothing. Both had amorous relations with ladies of Elizabeth's court and suffered disgrace and imprisonment as a result.
If the sonnets are taken to be autobiographical, and if Sonnets 1 to 126 are taken to be poems expressing the feelings of Shakespeare toward a specific young man, Southampton or Herbert or someone else, then there is the question of the nature of the relationship between Shakespeare and the young man. Much has been made of Sonnet number 20.
A woman's face with nature's own hand painted hast thou, the master mistress of my passion. A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change, as is false women's fashion. An eye more bright than theirs, less false in rolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling, which steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature, as she wrought thee, fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. But since she pricked thee out for woman's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy loves use their treasure.
The ideal of a loving friendship between two men based upon spiritual and intellectual kinship and totally independent of sex is, in spite of contrary claims and in spite of Sonnet 20, clearly the controlling theme of the first 126 sonnets.
Chapman, Daniel, Drayton, Spencer, Johnson, Barnes, and even Marlowe, although Marlowe died in 1593, have been suggested as possibilities for the rival poet of Sonnets 78 to 86. Sonnet 86 speaks of the proud full sail of his great verse, and Sonnet 85 mentions the precious phrase by all the muses filed. Identifiers of the rival poet must, therefore, seek among the great names of the period.
Then there is the Dark Lady. She is not beautiful by any conventional standards. She is totally without a moral sense. She is cruel and dishonest, and yet the poet finds himself chained to her by the chains of lust. The poet is disgusted by his own desire, repelled by the lady's lack of character, aware that his feeling for her is a sickness, and yet for a time powerless to break away. The painful ambiguity of the poet's feelings, the push and pull of his inner conflict, have resulted in some of the greatest lines ever written.
Expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth, fooled by these rebel powers that thee array, why dost thou pine within and suffer dearth, painting thy outward walls so costly gay?
Theorists who supported the case for William Lord Herbert as the young man of the sonnets at one time proposed Mary Fitton, Herbert's mistress, as the Dark Lady. Mistress Fitton, one of Elizabeth's maids of honor, managed to become the mother of three illegitimate children by different men, one of them Herbert.
George Bernard Shaw made use of the theory, naming Herbert and Mary Fitton in his play The Dark Lady of the Sonnets and in his preface to that play. Nevertheless, there are lines in Sonnet 152 that rule out Mary Fitton.
But thou art twice forsworn, to me love swearing, in act thy bed vow broke.
The Dark Lady is a married woman. Mary Fitton was not married when the sonnets were composed.
Apart from the central personal relationships presented in the sonnets, there is a great deal more about the feelings, attitudes, and ideas of the poet. The poet is sometimes confidently aware of his own talent, at other times dissatisfied with himself and his abilities. The poet is drawn toward youth and physical beauty, yet fully aware that such an attraction is ultimately damaging. There are those who find in the metaphor of Sonnet 37,
"So I, made lame by fortune's dearest spite,"
a direct reference to Shakespeare's own physical lameness. Such a conjecture reflects a lamentable, literal-mindedness.
William Wordsworth once wrote of Shakespeare's sonnets,
"Scorn not the sonnet, critic, you have frowned, mindless of its just honor. With this key, Shakespeare unlocked his heart."
It is possible that Wordsworth is right and that sonnets tell us a great deal about the personal life of Shakespeare. It is also possible that they tell us nothing at all about that personal life. It now seems certain that the identities of the young man, the rival poet, the Dark Lady, and Mr. W.H. will never be established beyond doubt.
There is a great deal of documentary evidence proving that Shakespeare remained an active Stratfordian throughout his long period of residence in London. It's probable he traveled frequently from London to Stratford, according to John Aubrey, writing in 1681.
"Mr. William Shakespeare was wont to go into Warwickshire once a year."
Aubrey offers some intriguing details about Shakespeare's annual journeys between London and Stratford. Shakespeare made a practice, says Aubrey, of stopping at the house of John Davenant, a vintner in Oxford. John Davenant was the father of Sir William Davenant, the 17th century playwright and theatrical manager. Aubrey says that Shakespeare
did commonly in his journey lie at this house in Oxon, where he was exceedingly respected. I have heard Parson Robert Davenant say that Mr. W. Shakespeare here gave him 100 kisses.
Now it seems that John Davenant's wife was
a very beautiful woman, and of very good wit, and of conversation extremely agreeable.
One result of Shakespeare's visits and Mrs. Davenant's agreeableness was, perhaps, Sir William Davenant himself.
Now, Sir William would sometimes, when he was pleasant over a glass of wine with his most intimate friends, e.g. Samuel Butler, author of Hudibras, etc., say that it seemed to him that he writ with the very spirit that Shakespeare, and was seemed contented enough to be thought his son. He would tell them the story as above, in which way his mother had a very light report, whereby she was called a whore.
This story, first told by Aubrey, was repeated and embellished throughout the next 100 years. Eventually, the story achieved the status of a good joke, and by the time William Olds retold it, in the middle of the 18th century, there is an obvious play for laughs.
If tradition be trusted, Shakespeare often baited at the Crown Inn or Tavern in Oxford in his journey to and from London. The landlady was a woman of great beauty and sprightly wit, and her husband, Mr. John Davenant, afterwards mayor of that city, a grave, melancholy man, who, as well as his wife, used much to delight in Shakespeare's pleasant company. Their son, young Will Davenant, afterwards Sir William, was then a little schoolboy in the town of about 7 or 8 years old, and so fond also of Shakespeare that whenever he heard of his arrival, he would fly from school to see him. One day, an old townsman, observing the boy running homeward, almost out of breath, asked him whither he was posting in that heat and hurry. He answered, to see his godfather Shakespeare. There's a good boy, said the other, but have a care that you don't take God's name in vain.
And so the Davenant story made its rounds, gathering delicious details as it gained momentum. There can be little doubt that the initial impetus was supplied by Sir William Davenant himself. That fact alone must give us pause. How many times in the course of human events has a man of the undeniable stature of Sir William Davenant encouraged the telling and retelling of a story that presents him as the offspring of an illicit affair and presents his mother as a woman of very light report? Evidently, the unpleasant implications of the story mattered not at all to Davenant upon those occasions over a glass of wine when he would permit the dream that he was the son of Shakespeare to overpower him.
It is, of course, possible that Shakespeare did stop over at John Davenant's home during the course of his trips to and from Stratford. It is also quite possible that he did not. Investigators not unduly swayed by the Davenant yarn have pointed out that the most direct route available to Shakespeare would bypass Oxford.
Beginning in 1596, there is a nearly continuous record linking Shakespeare with Stratford. There is a single grim line in the Stratford Parish Register.
1596, August 11. Born Hamnet, Phileas, William, Shakespeare.
Hamnet, the only son of William Shakespeare, was buried in Stratford in August of 1596. He was 11 years old. All that is known of this tragic event is the line in the register. There is no clear reflection of it in any of the works of Shakespeare. There are those who find in King John some echo of Hamnet's death in the laments of Constance for her son Arthur, and in the lines of Philip Falconbridge spoken as young Arthur's body is carried away.
Oh, bear him in thine arms. I am amazed, methinks, and lose my way among the thorns and dangers of this world. How easy dost thou take all England up? From forth this morsel of dead royalty, the life, the right, and truth of all this realm is fled to heaven.
It is also possible to recall the killings of the young boys of the English camp in Henry V, and the death of Macduff's son in Macbeth.
The document dated October 20th, 1596, is a draft of a grant of the privilege of bearing a coat of arms to John Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon and his children, issue, and posterity. The grant is made by William Dethick Garter, Principal King of Arms. The coat of arms is described...
Gould on a bend sable, the spear of the first steeled argent, and for his crest or cognizance, a falcon, his wings displayed argent, standing upon a wreath of his couleurs. Supporting a spear gould, steeled as aforesaid, set upon a helmet with mantles and tassels, as hath been accustomed and doth more plainly appear depicted on this margent. ¶¶
The issuing of this grant entitled William Shakespeare in the right of his father to call himself gentleman. There can be little doubt that William Shakespeare's money financed the application to the Herald's office for the grant of this coat of arms.
A record of a fine on the purchase of property dated May 4, 1597, establishes that William Shakespeare purchased from one William Underhill a house with two barns and two gardens in Stratford-on-Avon for £60 sterling. This property, known as New Place, was a large house in the center of town. It was then about 100 years old, built of brick and timber with a frontage of 60 feet and a depth of 70 feet.
Also in 1597, there was an attempt made through the courts by John and Mary Shakespeare, Shakespeare's parents, to recover Mary's lost inheritance, a house and land at Wilmcote. Again, it is highly likely that son William financed this proceeding.
There is a draft of a grant from the Herald's office, dated November 17, 1599, authorizing John Shakespeare and his children to impale upon their arms the ancient arms of the said Arden of Wellingcote. There is no indication that this grant, which would permit the Shakespeares to combine their newly granted arms with those of the Arden family, was ever officially made. The draft stands as an evidence of further pursuit of position and prestige.
The Stratford Parish Register records the burial of John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father, on September 8, 1601. No will is known, but subsequent records indicate that William inherited from his father two houses in Henley Street, Stratford. It is not entirely surprising that some investigators, reviewing the facts concerning the Shakespearean pursuit of a coat of arms, the ever-expanding Shakespearean dealings in real estate, the Shakespearean malt holding, and the Shakespearean suits for the recovery of disturbingly small sums of money, have reached black conclusions concerning Shakespeare's character. It is possible to add the facts together so that a portrait of an avaricious and miserly status seeker emerges.
There are fortunately serious objections to such a portrait. It must be remembered that records of business transactions and records of lawsuits are preserved while other records are lost. It must be remembered that legal records are of a necessity coldly factual. It must also be remembered that what may seem at first glance to be small sums of money become larger when translated into 17th century buying power. There is no doubt that Shakespeare, when his activities in the London theater began to yield a substantial financial return, became interested in putting his money to work. There is no doubt that Shakespeare was interested in improving the social position of his family.
Is he therefore a greedy skinflint? Is it essential that a great poet dramatist, in order to prove his greatness, throw away all his worldly goods and devote himself to the pursuit of poverty?
Not one letter written by William Shakespeare has been preserved. There is, however, a letter written to Shakespeare, dated October 25, 1598, from Stratfordian Richard Quiney. Richard Quiney was upon two occasions bailiff of Stratford and was the father of Thomas Quiney, who married Shakespeare's daughter, Judith, in 1616. In this letter, Richard Quiney asks Shakespeare for a loan to meet expenses in London and to aid him in making an investment.
Loving countryman, I am bold of you as of a friend, craving your help. You shall friend me much in helping me out of the debts I owe in London. I thank God, and much quiet my mind, which would not be indebted. I am now towards the court in hope of answer for the dispatch of my businesses. You shall neither lose credit nor money by me, the Lord willing. And now need to fear, but all hearty thankfulness, I will hold my time and content your friend. And if we bargain further, you shall be the paymaster yourself.
Here at least we have Shakespeare on friendly terms with a fellow townsman, and a tacit assumption of Shakespeare's generosity.
It is probable that Shakespeare returned to Stratford to take up permanent residence sometime between 1610 and 1612, without, however, totally severing his connection with London and London associates. The 1709 account of Nicholas Rowe of Shakespeare's final years places him in Stratford.
The latter part of his life was spent, as all men of good sense will wish theirs may be, in ease, retirement, and the conversation of his friends. He had the good fortune to gather an estate equal to his occasion, and, in that, to his wish, and is said to have spent some years before his death at his native Stratford.
Early in the year 1616, Shakespeare called in Francis Collins, a solicitor of Warwick, to prepare a last will and testament. The original of this will has been preserved. There are a good many interlineations and other evidences of revision. The final version was signed on March 25, 1616. In the will, Shakespeare first makes disposition of his soul and body.
I commend my soul into the hands of God my Creator, hoping and assuredly believing, through the only merits of Jesus Christ my Savior, to be made partaker of life everlasting, and my body to the earth whereof it is made.
You've been listening to This Was a Man. Today, the fourth program in a five-part documentary of William Shakespeare's life. The players were John Hulton as Thomas Thorpe, Ben Wright as William Shakespeare, Joseph Burns as Wordsworth, Norman Belkin as William Olds, Richard Peel as the Herald and Nicholas Rowe, Bruce Timpson as Richard Quiney.